I'm Dory Smith for Regime Change Radio, a half-hour program on the importance of voting to bring about regime change in America. Our guest today is Andy Sauer, Executive Director of the Connecticut Office of Common Cause. His group led the way in demanding investigations into the Roland administration and in calling for Governor John G. Roland to resign. For many in groups like Common Cause, the case of the embattled governor has become a test case for national ethics laws and honesty in government. The Republican governor persisted for most of last year in defending himself from accusations that he took gifts from Connecticut contractors. A top member of his administration, Lawrence E. Alabozek, had already confessed to accepting payoffs from people doing business with the state. A December 24, 2003 Hartford Current story by staff writers John Lender and Dave Altamari laid out the facts against Roland, and he apologized to voters shortly thereafter. For Andy Sauer at Common Cause, it is a victory after years of work advocating for change in Connecticut and a restoration of ethics here. It comes down to a problem of big money politics for him. His organization is nonpartisan. It has won support from both Democratic and Republican politicians on the issue of campaign finance reform. We spoke on President's Day, February 16th, even as exhaustive three-page subpoenas were being prepared for the governor's office. 3 days later, on the 19th, the Willimantic Chronicle reported that Roland's travel and expense reports, office, residential, and cellular phone records, all calendars, appointment books, and all schedules had been subpoenaed. The Hartford Current on the same day reported that the subpoena seeks every memo and every letter that came through Roland's office, going back to January 1, 1995, 3 days before he took office. It is no longer a question of whether or not Connecticut politics will have an impact on the next presidential election, but of how much the Republican Party will be impacted, and of whether or not citizens groups like Common Cause can have a corrective influence that leads from Hartford to Washington. Andy Sauer of the good government group Common Cause joins us today to discuss campaign finance reform, the State Ethics Commission, and the controversy surrounding the possible impeachment of Republican Governor John Roland. Andy, please give us an update on what's going on today. This is Monday that we're talking, and a lot's happened since last week.
Absolutely. Well, this must be, because it's a holiday, must be the one day where things have kind of quieted down a bit. Nonetheless, there's still a lot of talk about what happened last week with the Ethics Commission. On Friday, the Ethics Commission voted to allow the Executive Director of the Ethics Commission, Alan Plosky, to submit an opinion regarding the governor's actions. It's supposed to be generic, that is, that it he would not be able to apply it to the current situation, but nonetheless, everyone was looking for guidance on this particular issue and independently would apply it as they saw fit.
Now, first, let's just talk a little bit about the Republicans in the state and the president. On Friday, the 13th, John Lender's headline in the Hartford Current read, "Ethics Panel on Hot Seat," and the State Ethics Commission had just then begun to look at the issue of impeaching the state's Republican governor. And then on page A3, there was a small item with the headline, "Public Trust in Bush Sinks to Lowest Point Poll Finds." And, of course, now we're looking at a poll. This was an ABC News Washington Post poll that found 52% of the American people tested in that one felt that Bush was untrustworthy. 42% did not. And so he's definitely slipping. Is it worthwhile to discuss Connecticut polls about Governor Roland? Is it more worthwhile to discuss the potential impact that they might have on the president?
Well, it's interesting you should say that. Naturally, I tend to focus more on the Connecticut situation. Connecticut Common Cause is a citizens' lobby, primarily at the state capitol in Hartford. Although I am part of a national organization, I do keep track of what's happening on the national level, and of course, have plenty to talk about and plenty of opinions regarding that. But I mean, regarding our governor and sort of the plummeting popularity, I think what really bothers most people, the average Connecticut resident, is that the governor lied. He admits lying. And the way he lied, I think, was particularly egregious and sort of undermined the public's trust. Back in December, he essentially berated the media for their questions regarding the cottage. He said that he had paid for it, you know, in a variety of ways, equity loans, that sort of thing. And then 5 days later admits that he lied. It was just the way it happened, the way that he steadfastly insisted his innocence, the way he had many times in a lot of other scandals, only 5 days later to admit that he lied when caught in a lie. And that's really when things started to turn, when his shine had been tarnished. And so since then, there hasn't really been much he can do right now to restore the public's trust, and that's what you're seeing in the poll. I mean, sure, a lot of Connecticut residents, I forget what the exact poll numbers were, but want to wait to see what happens with the federal trial before they impeach and that sort of thing. And I respect people's opinion on that because they want to. People still do believe someone is innocent before proven guilty, and I think that, you know, deep in their hearts, they're not sure if lying to the people is necessarily an impeachable offense. But I do think that they have lost trust in him, and that's where his waning popularity stems from.
So let's go right into the issue of the Ethics Committee itself and what it might look at. And tell me what kinds of things that Common Cause is doing here. And just, you know, to all of us who don't understand your role in this, tell us what you do for the state as a watchdog group.
Well, first, regarding the Ethics Commission, there are two bodies right now. There's the Ethics Commission, which Friday released the opinion regarding gifts from state developers or gifts given to public officials. And then there's the Impeachment Committee that the legislature has convened to examine the case for impeachment. Regarding the Impeachment Committee, as far as I know, they've just hired an attorney or have appointed an attorney, and they're going to begin looking at the sort of the case and the merits of the case and the necessarily possible case for impeachment. The Ethics Commission has been mainly – the role the Ethics Commission has kind of played so far was when initially the whole story broke about the governor accepting gifts and lying about accepting gifts, his stance and the stance of others was that he didn't break the law, when in fact he had broke the law. He broke state ethics laws. There's an important distinction to be made here in the law. Criminal laws apply to everyone. They apply to you. They apply to me. They apply to every citizen. It's the type of things that, you know, range from, as we all know, parking tickets to, you know, burglary, robbery, that sort of things. But ethics laws apply to state servants. They apply to elected officials. They apply to state workers. They're to ensure that people who work for the state or on behalf of the state or for the state will not use their power or influence for personal gain. That's the importance of ethics laws, and that's a critical distinction because many people don't see ethics laws as more of a nuisance. The point of the matter is that most states and governments never conceived that their leaders would ever use, maybe it's surprising, would never conceive that their leaders would use their public office for personal gain. In Connecticut, we have some of the best ethics laws in the country. They could be better. They could be much better. But essentially, when the governor said, "I did not break any laws," that really kind of showed how much he valued the state's ethics laws, at least in my opinion. And that was one of the reasons why Common Cause in Connecticut submitted a statement saying requesting his resignation and that if he did not resign, requested that the House begin impeachment proceedings. The Ethics Commission role, at least in this part of the scandal, when the scandal first broke, legislators asked the Ethics Commission to interpret the state's ethics laws, especially as it applied to this scandal. Now, the Ethics Commission said that it can only provide a general opinion. They completed an advisory opinion that basically said no elected official can accept a gift more than $100. Some of the gifts in question here were worth thousands of dollars, hot tubs, cathedral ceilings, that sort of thing. When the Ethics Commission wrote their advisory opinion, the governor's lawyers requested that they not issue an opinion and ask the executive director of the Ethics Commission to stop commenting on the case. That happened for a month. Last Friday, the Ethics Commission met again, decided that they would, in fact, issue an advisory opinion. And the advisory opinion said that no elected official, no public official, can accept a gift more than $100. They didn't apply it to the governor directly, but everyone else in this state did. So in essence, the governor broke state ethics laws. Now, the investigation committee, the investigatory committee at the legislature, is really what we're looking at as sort of a two-part process of impeachment. In January, legislative leaders decided that it was time to form an investigatory committee on the case of impeachment. This committee is going to meet and kind of review the facts. It won't be unlike that of, you know, some of the hearings we were used to in the 80s, Iran-Contra and Watergate. Basically, committee members will be asking people questions. They'll be trying to get to the bottom of it. They'll have limited powers in the sense that they can't make people testify against themselves. People can always declare the Fifth. But in essence, they will be asking questions to determine whether or not they should recommend impeachment. If they do recommend impeachment, then it comes to the Senate for a trial. And no one's ever done this before. It's never gotten that far to the Senate. And so no one knows what it's going to look like, if it'll be held in the Senate chambers or for what matter. But at that point, we'll be in uncharted waters. So this committee, essentially what they're doing is they're trying to get the facts of the case. And they have an attorney, they have subpoena powers, and they can subpoena people to appear before them. They can't make people testify against themselves, and certainly they won't be able to access some of the data that are currently in possession of federal investigators. Now, the other part of the process, this sort of ongoing process, is the federal investigation. And the federal investigators are not abiding by any timetable, any sort of electoral timetable or impeachment timetable. They're proceeding with the case as they have been for more than a year now. Last March, as many of your listeners will recall, the governor's former deputy chief of staff pled guilty to accepting bribes to steer contracts to TBI construction. Deputy chief of staff, you're high up there on the food chain. I mean, there are really only two people that you can call your boss, the chief of staff, or in this case, the co-chief of staff, Peter Ellis, and the governor. So when he pled guilty, that's when really the public started taking notice, saying something is rotten in Hartford. But the federal investigators have the cooperation of this high-ranking governor's office official, and supposedly they've subpoenaed others and interviewed others and have files and boxes and boxes of state files to their investigation. However, a federal investigation can take a long time, and sometimes it can take up to 2 years or more. Does the state have that luxury to have someone who could ultimately, be tried as a criminal? Do they have that luxury to have them lead their state? I don't know, and that's what the legislature is going to have to decide. For my part, as executive director of Common Cause, the greatest sin has been committed already. The chief executive of this state, the governor, the top elected official, has lied to the people. I don't see how you can feel that you have confidence or trust in government when your top leader lies to you and only tells the truth when caught in a lie. For me, that spells really a need for some drastic changes.
And so that brings us to today. But let's start back at the beginning and discuss the whole candidacy and final election of Roland and what it meant in terms of money, power, this state, and the Republicans as you see it.
First, money in politics is not necessarily a partisan issue. Essentially, political money goes to those who have power. It's to court power. It's to gain favor with those who have power. So, in some circles it could be Democrats, in some circles it could be Republicans, and Common Cause is a nonpartisan organization. We're dedicated to responsible government. So this is money in politics is not a Democratic issue, it's not a Republican issue, it's an American issue. This is the type of thing that coast to coast is a problem. I like to say it's America's dirty little secret. Everyone knows about it, from politicians to lobbyists to major contributors to corporate interests to the public. Everyone knows that money in politics distorts the process, distorts the debate, and really it's run amok. So, to characterize it as just a partisan issue is incorrect, and some of the best people in campaign finance are Republicans, like Senator John McCain or Connecticut's own Christopher Shays. Regarding Roland's 2002 election, you kind of have to look at this in two election cycles, the 1998 election cycle and the 2002 election cycle. I guess the governor perhaps was expecting a contested race, and he did get him. And he his people went out there and raised a lot of money. The people that he raised money from, some of them, such as the Tommaso Brothers Incorporated, received a large amount, more than $100 million worth of no-bid contracts. The thing to understand about no-bid contracts is when the state puts out a request for a proposal or an RFP, it's done in a competitive manner, and it's the state, it's done in a public and open manner for the state to pick the company that best suits the job. Well, there are essentially two kinds of contracts that the state does. There's the request for proposal, and this is sort of an open request. It's printed in the paper, a request for a proposal on, say, to build a parking garage of some sort. And a person, a company, submits their proposal, their idea, and a price tag for it. And this is the decision-making process is done in the open. Everyone can see, and it's generally considered to be a very competitive process to bid for a contract. In 1994, the Connecticut legislature adopted sort of the fast track, the fast track awarding of contracts. This allows a state agency such as the Department of Public Works or the Department of Transportation to pick three, four companies that they think would be good for a contract. It's behind closed doors, five people, and the contract is awarded very quickly. It's very hidden because none of the records are out there in the open. No one knows exactly why someone was picked over another, and it's done very quickly, hence the name Fast Track. The TBI Construction, which is a Tommaso Brothers Incorporated subsidiary, won three Fast Track contracts totaling more than $100 million. To win one is huge. To win one Fast Track contract is an accomplishment. To win three is unheard of. It's amazing. And I think at that point, people started to sort of think that perhaps they did have sort of ties. Even back then, I remember people sort of, Bill Curry was raising sort of the possibility that perhaps the Tommasos courted favor with the Rowland administration through campaign contributions. It wasn't until 6 months after the election, that the 2002 election, that the news of the federal investigation became public and that someone actually pled guilty to steering contracts to TBI Construction.
Let's talk a little bit about the commissioners that are judging this whole affair and the whole history of looking at this governor and how long it's taken for these charges to become official.
Do you mean the impeachment committee members?
That's right.
I think people are going to have a hard look at the facts now. I think they're going to see things. And at least from where I'm standing, it looks bad. The gifts were received. There were vacations. There have been all sorts of sort of, if not unethical behavior, borderline unethical behavior. And the fact is, the very fact of the matter is, these companies, these individuals that have been sort of named in this scandal, did receive benefits from state government. You have one major contractor that's building the airport. You have another major contractor that's building the airport's garage. Building the Long Lane Juvenile Detention Center in Middletown. It's building the Bridgeport Superior Courthouse, or was, before the state took the contract away. You have one person who's involved in a real estate venture with the governor who also received public dollars. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. The scandal sort of confirms what a lot of people sort of have suspected for a long time. There are insiders and outsiders, and the insiders are awarded special privileges. They're awarded state contracts. And they're awarded favor from those in power.
Tell me a little bit about what your expectations are of the commission itself and the people on it.
Well, I would hope that they do look at things fairly. I hope that they would consider the state's ethics laws, as I mentioned earlier. There's a difference between someone breaking criminal laws and someone breaking ethical laws. Someone who breaks a criminal law has violated sort of society's codes. Someone who breaks unethical laws has violated the public's trust. And so I imagine, they'll debate the merits of each case, look at it, and then once they decide, I'm almost positive they probably will vote to impeach. I don't see how they can't. And in an election year, with the popularity down, with everything that's happened, it would be hard to look people in the face and say, I didn't think he did anything wrong. Now, after that point, it goes to the Senate and it goes to a trial. And so... regarding the particulars of this committee, it's hard to know what's going to happen. And I think they're trying to do this in a methodical way, to be above reproach, to sort of demonstrate that this was not a political decision. But, I mean, the short end of it is I don't see how they can't impeach. The man lied to the people of Connecticut about accepting illegal gifts. It doesn't get much worse than that.
And this particular governor was very visible whenever the Republican White House staff was in the state and when the president himself was in the state, and visible during the crisis on 9/11, and then, too, had involvement with Homeland Security.
Well, he's a prominent friend of President Bush. As a matter of fact, leading up to the gubernatorial election in 2002, and even in the days after the election, it was long rumored that the governor would be tapped for some sort of administration post. And, I mean, as you might recall, he didn't declare that he was in the race till the summer of 2002, which is kind of late. It's not to say that he wasn't out there raising money, but he hadn't decided. And many people, many Capitol insiders, speculated that he was going to be tapped. At one point, I heard for Homeland Security under Tom Ridge that he was going to receive a prominent role there. And sometimes I wonder how this scandal is going to play out in this upcoming presidential election. I think I remember reading somewhere that, in 2000, this year, the Republicans want to win handedly. They want to win decisively. They don't want to, I think sometimes they feel that 2000, that Americans feel like 2000 was sort of this asterisk year of an election year. And from what I've read, in 2004, they want to win. They don't just want to win. They want to win by a landslide to sort of show that the people have spoken, a mandate of sorts. One of the goals that I read about was that they want to sweep the tri-state area, which would be a huge thing for Republicans to do, to take New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. A lot of that has to do, I think, sometimes with the fears of terrorism and that sort of thing. But you have to wonder, at some point, are they going to say to the governor, you're hurting us this year. You have to stop, because we were hoping to take Connecticut, and now, as long as scandal continues to dog the state's leading Republican, it makes us look bad. And I'm just speculating. I mean, these are the type of things you read all over the place, you know, essentially reading the tea leaves of sorts.
We're talking with Andy Sauer of Common Cause in Connecticut. Andy, let's go to the discussion on campaign finance reform and talk a little bit about some of the aspects that could have saved us from this crisis in the state that we're looking at right now.
Well, campaign finance reform in Connecticut has been a long process. Common Cause, I think, has been behind it for more than 10 years, but 10 years I know of in sort of the past bills I've read and the past literature that Common Cause has produced. So they've been fighting this for 10 years. I mean, this has been a long-standing issue for Common Cause, the organization. I know specifically in Connecticut, the organization has been trying for a good 10 years to get this implemented. Nationally, it's been around since the beginning, since the days of John Gardner when he first started the organization. But to your earlier question, if we had campaign finance reform, could this have been averted? It depends when. My mantra in this is the corruption trail starts on the campaign trail. And at least regarding this current scandal, regarding the current players such as TBI Construction, which is a subsidiary of the Tommaso Company, Tommaso Brothers Incorporated, they started getting close with the governor somewhere in the vicinity of 1996. When the governor started his reelection campaign in earnest, there must have been some sort of function, and a lot of the key players named in this scandal made political contributions on the same day. I mean, to me, as an outside observer looking at the public records, that's when I see when it started. A year earlier, they lost a $40 million contract to build the courthouse in New Britain, their hometown. That must have been galling. That must have been frustrating. They are a New Britain dynasty, and to lose such a major contract in their hometown must have upset them. I think someone took him aside and said, hey, if you want to play the game, this is what you have to do. So when the governor's reelection campaign started in earnest in June of 96, they were first in line. So, I mean, if to have avoided it, we would have had to have campaign finance reform sometime, you know, before 1996. 1994 would have been the time to have it. avoiding this scandal is really not not so much the point as much as avoiding future scandals. The state is coming off, I think, is this the fourth scandal in 4 years? I mean, when you go back to Ghanem, Giordano, Sylvester, Connecticut has fallen victim to scandal after scandal, in a large part because of campaign contributions. If you look at the Sylvester scandal, before he tried to get kickbacks, before he tried to get payment, he was looking for a way to funnel $200,000 of illegal campaign contributions into his coffers through the state Republican Party. Again, the corruption trail starts in the campaign trail. Now, Ghanem and Giordano, these were municipal scandals, and on the inside, it had more to do with municipal corruption, bribes, and kickbacks. But I think if we were given the opportunity to look into the records, I still think that we would find a lot of these corruptive influences introduce themselves on the campaign trail.
And define soft money, clean money. Talk a little bit about the legislation, such as McCain-Feingold.
Soft money. It's a very complicated issue. Soft money is unregulated money. In the past, it was sort of the money, and that was the reason why they call it soft money. It was difficult to follow, you know, the chain of hands where it went through. Usually you donated to a party or a particular committee of a party, and it sort of went into this pool and then was dispersed other ways. And there are a lot of varieties of that. And clean money, which is what we are promoting, is essentially a way for candidates to take themselves out of the political money game, frankly, from a lot of people who are looking for influence in exchange for campaign contributions. Clean money is essentially public money, publicly funded political campaigns. A candidate would demonstrate viability by raising a certain threshold of money, $200,000 of small contributions, $100 or less. Once they raise that threshold, they would receive election grants, in essence, and that would free them from having to do the fundraisers, having to make the phone calls for people to donate their campaigns. It would allow them to get out, shake the hands of the people, you know, deliver their message to the people, whatever it may be. And then, in addition, if they are up against a candidate who isn't a clean election candidate, who outspends them, the clean election fund would kick in. They would get the same. They would be able to get money that matched their opponent's campaign dollars. So, if in the case of the 2002 election, had we had clean election, if the governor had spent as he spent $6 million, Bill Curry would have gotten $4 million of public money to keep pace. The idea is to level the playing field, allow both people an equal sort of range of communication.
Now, you've said that this works for Maine and Arizona, so it's been tested.
Yes, it has.
And who in Connecticut do you think might lead the way in explaining it to the Connecticut electorate this time around?
Well, there have been several people who have been vocal supporters of this. You know, in the among the legislature, the two co-chairmen of the Government Administration and Elections Committee, Representative James O'Rourke and Senator Don DeFranco, have been speaking out in support of clean money. Also, Secretary of the State Susan Bisewitz, State Treasurer Denise Napier, and I've even heard the Attorney General Richard Blumenthal sing its praises. So, I mean, there have been a lot of people who are in favor of it. In the past, and in 2000, clean money passed through both sides of the both sides of the legislature, through the House and the Senate, and was vetoed by the governor. I think this year people kind of feel that, given this scandal, that perhaps you know, maybe the governor will not be inclined to veto it this year, especially since it involves him.
Andy Sauer is the executive director of the Connecticut Office of Common Cause, a nonpartisan good government group. For further information, you can log on to their website at commoncause.org and find the Connecticut office from there. Andy Sauer will be speaking at an upcoming event at UConn on government corruption. This event is sponsored by a coalition of campaign finance reform groups and the Connecticut Citizens Action Group. It is scheduled for March 3rd at 7 p.m. For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores. For further information, write to me, Dory Smith, at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.